To introduce today's guest speaker, it's my pleasure to introduce Penn State's Executive Vice President and Provost, Dr. Rodney Erickson.
Thank you, Patty, and good afternoon, everyone. One of this year's liveliest debates is about healthcare reform. Policy analysts are trying to find ways to control healthcare costs, increase coverage, and improve the quality of care. At the same time, individuals are trying to control their own medical costs and improve outcomes by living healthier lifestyles. At Penn State, enrollment in our Health Matters program is growing steadily, I'm pleased to say. Today, we'll hear a perspective on healthcare issues from an expert who knows healthcare from the inside. Dr. Benjamin Carson is a professor of neurosurgery, oncology, plastic surgery, and pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He is also director of pediatric neurosurgery at Hopkins and the co-director of the Craniofacial Center. This is the second time I'll have the privilege of hearing Dr. Carson. I recall that he was our commencement speaker at the College of Medicine graduation in the spring of 1996, where he gave a wonderfully inspiring address. Dr. Carson majored in psychology at Yale University and graduated from the University of Michigan School of Medicine. He completed both an internship in general surgery and a residency in neurological surgery at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Carson is renowned for his groundbreaking neurosurgeries, which include surgical control of chronic seizures in children and the first successful separation of twins joined at the back of the head. Dr. Carson has authored more than 100 neurosurgical publications, along with four best-selling books. His books, Gifted Hands, Think Big, The Big Picture, and Take the Risk, describe his childhood experience as a surgeon and philosophy for success. Dr. Carson co-founded Angels of the OR, a nonprofit foundation that provides grants to families with medical expenses not covered by insurance. And in 1994, Dr. Carson and his wife Candy, who's with us here today, founded the Carson Scholars Fund, which awards scholarships to outstanding students in grades 4 through 11. To date, Carson Scholars have attended 184 colleges and universities, including Penn State, where we've had 12 Carson Scholars over the years and currently have 3 Carson Scholars, including one who's with us today. Emily Wolf is a freshman majoring in aerospace engineering. We're glad to have you here today, Emily. Are there any other Carson Scholars who made it today? I think they're in class, I hope so. Dr. Carson has been awarded many honorary doctoral degrees and dozens of national merit citations. In 2008, he was recognized by U.S. News and World Report and Harvard Center for Public Leadership as one of America's best leaders. Also in 2008, Dr. Carson received the nation's highest civilian award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, from President George W. Bush. A talented neurosurgeon, author, and philanthropist, Dr. Carson will speak on the topic of healthcare and healthy lifestyles. Please give a warm Penn State welcome to Dr. Benjamin Carson.
Thank you very much. Is this working?
That's the house people.
Guess we'll have to use this one. That's no good. I like to walk around. Okay. I guess I'll have to be stationary today. Well, it's wonderful to be here at Penn State today. And for those of you who are students, recognize that this is the best time in your life. You know, when you're an undergraduate, all you have to do is eat, sleep, and study. It doesn't get any better than that. You know, it just gets worse as time goes on. So really, just enjoy this immensely. You know, it doesn't, You won't have it again. But, you know, medicine, for me, has been really the only thing that ever interested me. As a youngster, if there was ever a story, television, radio, about medicine, I was right there like a magnet listening. I even liked going to the doctor's office, and I guess that makes me kind of strange. Needles, syringes, anything, it was great. And the best thing in life was going to the hospital, because even though we would have to wait for many hours because we were in medical assistance before one of the interns or residents could see us, I would sit out in the hallway and listen to the PA system. Dr. Jones, Dr. Jones, to the emergency room, Dr. Johnson. They sounded so important. And I'd be thinking, one day they'll be saying, Dr. Carson, Dr. Carson. But of course now they would have beepers, so I still don't get to hear it. But it's important to have that dream, because, you know, sometimes that's the very thing that will push you past the obstacles and the discouragement and that you find along the way. But dreams aren't always good. Sometimes they have bad endings. I certainly remember a few summers ago the case of the Bajani twins, 29-year-old Iranian women. Their lifelong dream was to be separated. They were joined at the head. And they couldn't find anybody who would do it. And they searched the world. I remember when I was first contacted about their case, I told them about Chang and Ying Bunker, the original Siamese twins, who were born in Siam in the year 1811, hence the term Siamese twins, and how they lived to be 63 years old. But they weren't buying that. And they eventually found a team in Singapore who was willing to do the operation. It was a team that I had worked with previously. And they subsequently convinced me to come and join the effort. And I remember when I first met them, I was so impressed. They were so vivacious. They were full of energy. They had learned to speak English in only 7 months, if you can imagine that. Very intelligent. They both had college degrees. They both had law degrees. Only one wanted one, but they both had law degrees. You know. So, you know, they had a very thorough understanding of what it is that they were about to embark upon, more so than most people would. But they said something to me that really hit me. They said, Doctor, we would rather die than spend another day stuck together. And, you know, that seemed harsh to me, but then I put myself in their place. And I said, what if you were stuck to the person in the world you liked the most, but you couldn't get away from them for 1 second? To go to the bathroom for anything, how long would you like them? And I began to understand exactly what it is that they were going through. And you know, it's such an important exercise to put yourself in other people's places, particularly before you begin to criticize. And it will frequently give you a very, very different perspective. And you won't be nearly as critical and judgmental in those situations. But at any rate, we did proceed with that operation, and we were about 90% finished. Some people were starting to celebrate. I was not among them, because as we got to the very end, they began to bleed profusely and they died. And not everything that we do is successful, and that is particularly the case in medicine. If you know much about the history of medicine, the early days of kidney transplant, some people thought this was a fruitless effort. Heart transplants, lung transplants, livers, horrible mortality rates, but we learned, and now those things can be done quite routinely. And that is really the key, to learn from things that don't work to make progress. Thomas Edison said he knew 999 ways a light bulb did not work. And most of you have heard of the cleaning formula 409. Why did they call it that? The first 408 didn't work. But they learned, and eventually we came up with a good cleaning formula. I think about the great neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins, Walter Dandy, very famous, you know, 70, 80 years ago. And he did a lot of pioneering things. He was the first one to operate on the posterior fossa, the back part of the head. People thought that area was too small and that swelling would kill the patient. But he operated on someone with a posterior fossa lesion, and they died. And another one, and they died, and another. And the first 13, they all died. Can you imagine how discouraged he was? And I guess they didn't have malpractice lawyers. But at any rate, he persisted. I can't even imagine what he said to the 14th patient when they asked how the other 13 did. Probably said, nobody's complaining. But at any rate, you know, Now we're able to do those operations on a routine basis. And it's because we learn from those things that didn't work. And you know, no failure is a true failure as long as you learn from it. Now, before I go on, I just want to take one moment for a brief disclaimer. You know, nowadays everybody makes disclaimers. They say, you know, I'm on this corporate board, or, you know, I have this stock or whatever. So you take everything with a grain of salt. Well, what I've discovered in recent years is that it's virtually impossible to speak to a large group of people without offending someone. You know, when I was a kid, people used to say, sticks and stones break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Most of you young people probably never heard that saying. You know, names kill people now. People are just walking around with their feelings on their shoulders, waiting for somebody to say something so they can say, oh, did you hear what they said? And then they can't hear anything else. I was talking to a group one time about the difference between a human brain and a dog's brain. And a man got offended. He said, you can't talk about dogs like that. And then I was talking to a group about how the fashion industry makes the young women think they're supposed to be so skinny. Some of them look like they escaped from a concentration camp. And a Jewish man got offended. He said, you can't talk about concentration camps. That's too sensitive. It would be as if I said something to you about slavery. And I told him, you could talk about slavery all you want. It doesn't bother me. But some people choose to get offended. So my disclaimer is the following. It is not my intention to offend anyone this afternoon. And if anyone is offended, too bad. Because, you know, I do not believe in political correctness. And in fact, I believe that political correctness is a very destructive portion of our society today, which needs to be abolished. You know, when seems to me when I was studying American history that a lot of people who formulated this country came here because they were trying to escape from people who were telling them what they could say and what they could think. And here we come reintroducing it through the back door. And if we allow it, we will suffer the consequences of it. You know, I'm reminded of a young man who was a very successful businessman. And he loved to buy his mother a wonderful present every Mother's Day. He was running out of ideals. And then he came across these birds. They were fabulous birds. They could dance. They could sing, they could talk. He was thrilled. He said, I'll get two of them. And he sent them to his mother, and he couldn't wait to call her on Mother's Day and say, Mother, 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 how did you like those birds? And she said, they was good. He said, you didn't eat those birds, Mother. Those birds cost $5,000 a piece. They could dance, they could sing, they could talk. And she said, they should have said something. And you know, that's really the way it is when people don't speak up, when they allow political correctness to keep them silent, when they're not willing to really express their true feelings. You know, you look what happened in Nazi Germany. Most of those people did not believe in what Hitler was doing, but they kept their mouths shut. And you see what tragedy resulted there. And we need to remember who we are in this nation and not be silenced about it. If you really want to be inspired, you go back and you read about the people who established this nation. You read about some of the pioneering efforts. You read about some of the innovative thought that led to inventions that created the machinery that spurred on the Industrial Revolution. That was this country. This country that rose to the pinnacle so quickly because of those innovative and creative individuals that became the world's only superpower and was benevolent as a superpower. Don't believe those people who tell you that the United States is an evil nation. Because it is not. It has been much more benign than any other powerful pinnacle nation in the history of the world, has done more good for more people, has established more opportunity, and brought more well-being financially to all kinds of people. We need not try to pattern ourselves after anybody else. We are unique in who we are. And I want you to think about this. This nation was established by a bunch of ragtag militiamen who were able to defeat the most powerful empire on the face of the earth. Think about what it took to do that. And I think there were probably things involved that are unseen that allowed us to be established as a nation. You think about World War II, when nations of the world were falling like dominoes, one after another, to evil Axis powers, tyrannical powers, the whole world about to come under subjugation, except for one thing, this country, the United States of America, a country with the ability to send its young men from the cities, the suburbs, the country, to fight a war on two different fronts of the world. A country that with the ability to send its young women into the factories to produce more airplanes, tanks, and mortars than anybody could imagine. A country that through its industrial might and its determination changed the course of the world. That's the nation that you live in. And we would do extremely well to never forget that point and to do everything we can to make it into an even better nation. But we don't have to ever be ashamed of the things that this nation has provided for the world. Well, at any rate, you know, I had a difficult time realizing my dream of becoming a physician. You know, my parents got divorced early on. You know, my mother was one of 24 children, got married at age 13. They moved from rural Tennessee to Detroit. He was working in a factory. She discovered he was a bigamist, had another family. I remember telling that story at a graduation at the University of Utah. Nobody thought it was that strange. But see that, I probably offended somebody. Of course, they don't do that in Utah anymore. Everybody knows that, right? Now it's Texas. But at any rate, you know, we moved from Detroit to Boston to live with her older sister and brother-in-law. Typical tenement, multiple families, sirens, gangs, murders. Both of my older cousins were killed, rats, roaches, the whole nine yards. But, you know, when I look back on it, it wasn't that bad because it put fire in my belly. It made me want to escape from all of those things. And maybe if I'd grown up with a good upbringing, I might not have had the same determination, might not have faced the obstacles that came along with the same degree of vigor. So, you know, to me, the thing that's important is not where you came from, but where you're going. And the fact that we have opportunities that exist for all of us, particularly in a free society such as the one we live in, and we need to do everything we can to make sure that we protect those freedoms. Well, my mother's goal was to work hard enough to be on her own again, and after a few years, she was, and we moved back to Detroit, still in a dilapidated area with plenty of wildlife, but at least she was independent, and I was a fifth grader, and I was perhaps the worst fifth grader you've ever seen. I thought I was really stupid. All my classmates agreed with that assessment. In fact, you know, my nickname was Dummy. They always teased me about how stupid I was. But I exacted my revenge because one of the things that I really loved to do was to get other people kicked out of class. And I was really good at it, you know. I would study my classmates and I would figure out what made them really angry. And then I would just irritate them until they were about to explode. But I would never push the last button to make them explode until we were in class and the teacher was nearby. And I would do it, they would explode, the teacher would kick them out, I'd say, yeah, this is great, I was having a good time. But, you know, there was this one girl, she was Miss Goody Two-Shoes. Everybody remembers the Miss Goody Two-Shoes, right? Everything pristine, perfect, on time, neat, makes everybody else look like a total jerk. I said, wow, wouldn't it be great to get her kicked out of class? But, you know, she was a tough nut to crack. It was hard to figure out what made her angry, but I kept studying her, and I finally figured it out. And I tell you, the steam was coming out of her ears. She was so mad. She was about to explode, but I didn't push the last button. I waited till we were in class. Lo and behold, she sat right down in the seat in front of me. And I said, "The Lord is good." And as the teacher approached, I started irritating her. I pushed the last button to make her explode, but she didn't explode. She just quietly turned around, and she said, "You and me on the playground at recess." So that didn't work out too well. I became a brain surgeon, and she became a professional wrestler. But I did stop bothering people so much after that. But, you know, the kind of student that I was is very reminiscent of many students that I see today. You know, I have a program at the hospital. I bring in 800 students at a time, show them slides of the human brain, the kind of things that go on in a research institution. And then we talk about human potential, and at the end I allow them to ask me questions. And sometimes I ask the questions. I remember asking, "How many of you can name for me 5 NBA players?" Do you know virtually every hand went up, they could all name 5 NBA players? Major League Baseball players, no problem. NFL players, no problem. Rap stars and movie stars and rap singers, no problem. I said, "Who can name for me 5 Nobel Prize winners?" Do you know of 800, only 10 hands went up? I said, "Leave your hands up because I'm going to call on one of you." All the hands went down. Well, what does that tell you? And then I said, "Well, look, this is the information age, the age of technology. Who can tell me what a microprocessor is? Figure that would be easy." Of course, they were all weary by now, so only one young man raised his hand. I called on him. He proudly stood up and he said, "A microprocessor is a tiny processor." That was it. That was the extent of his knowledge, extraordinarily superficial. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of sad because, you know, we only produce in this country 60,000 engineers a year, 40% of whom are foreigners. It sounds like a lot, but compare that to China that produces 392,000 engineers a year and that we're in a technological age. We need to change that equation, and we need to change it in a hurry. Well, we're going to disappear from the top of the list of world leaders in another generation. And all of you can do something about that. You all have a sphere of influence, and it's incredibly important that we begin to focus on these kinds of issues and change the dynamic and move away from just the things that are easy and move toward the kind of know-how and can-do spirit that made this into the great nation that it was. You know, we used to be the manufacturing giant of the world, and now we've become primarily a service industry. We cannot continue as a pinnacle nation unless we bring back that innovation, that can-do spirit, unless we energize that segment of our society that brings such things about. And yes, we are the pinnacle nation in the world. There's no question about that. Number one, no competition, going to be there forever. That's what all pinnacle nations think. That's what ancient Egypt thought, Rome, Greece, Great Britain. Where are they now? What happened to each one of them? Same thing, they became enamored of sports and entertainment, lifestyles of the rich and famous. They lost their moral compass, and they went right down the tubes. And some people say, that can't happen to us. But the fact of the matter is, it's already happening. And the real question is, can we stop it? Can we be the first pinnacle nation in the history of the world to learn from those that preceded us and take corrective action? Or must we all inexorably go down the same path of self-destruction? It's a question that we need to all ask ourselves seriously. I personally believe that we're different. Because you see, this nation is the child of all the other nations that preceded us. And we should have the welfare of every nation at heart, as opposed to just our own selfish interest. And I think we can change it, and we can make that difference. Well, at any rate, There I was, languishing as a student, not doing well. But fortunately, my mother believed in me when nobody else did. And she was always saying, Benjamin, you're much too smart to be bringing home grades like this. I brought them home anyway. But she was always saying that. And, you know, most of you probably know the story of how she made us read two books apiece from the Detroit Public Libraries and submit to her written book reports, which she couldn't read, but we didn't know that. She put little check marks and underline and stuff like that. But, you know, that was a major turning point for me. As I began to read all kinds of stories of incredible people and began to recognize the kind of hard work and dedication that was necessary in order to realize the potential that each one of us has. And I began to understand that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you is you. And once I knew that, I knew that I was going to be successful. I knew that it was something that I could control. And that is one of the very wonderful things about living in a land of opportunity. Well, at any rate, one of the things that my wife and I became very interested in is trying to spread that philosophy around this country, to get away from the what can you do for me attitude and back to the can-do spirit. And we were cognizant of a study that had been done looking at the ability of 8th grade equivalent students in 22 countries to solve so-called complex math and science problems. In that survey of 22 nations, we ranked number 21 out of 22. We barely beat out number 22. We were extremely alarmed, and we said, what can be done about this? And we started giving out scholarships, $1,000 scholarships to students starting in the 4th grade, initially out of our own pockets. For students who achieved at the highest academic levels and also demonstrated humanitarian qualities, that they cared about other people. Because you don't need people who are just smart but don't care about anybody else. We need a different type of leadership. And we need to develop those people early on so that they can help this country to realize its real potential. Well, you know, that program started 14 years ago. We gave our first scholarships out. 25 students in Baltimore. And now we're giving out 500 to 600 scholarships a year, and that number is growing. We have almost 4,000 scholars in 34 states, including over 400 in the state of Pennsylvania. The program has won the Simon Award, which is given to one philanthropic organization per year. Comes with a check for $250,000. The Ronald McDonald House Award, also one organization per year, another six-figure check. The Ford Freedom Award, also a big check. But of course, it's not done for the checks. It's done for the effect. Many teachers have told us when they have a scholar in their classroom, the grade point average of the whole class goes up by as much as a whole point over the next year. And to change the perception of what being smart means, and to have more people moving in that direction, we can begin to fill that gap. We can begin to change those attitudes. We also have a reading room program. You'd be amazed at how many schools do not have a library. You put in these fabulous places that no kid could possibly pass up, has all these fascinating things in it, including wonderful books, and they get points for every book they read, the number of hours they spend there, and they can train them in for gifts, presence. And initially they do it for the prizes, but it doesn't take long before that translates into much better academic performance. Recognizing that 70 to 80% of high school dropouts are functionally illiterate, and we need to truncate that process early on so that we're not feeding into this great group of people who really are a drag on society and don't need to be, because all of us have these fabulous brains. You know, the human brain is the most important and the most sophisticated organ system in the universe. It has billions and billions of neurons, hundreds of billions of interconnections, remembers everything you've ever seen, everything you've ever heard, can process more than 2 million bits of information per second. How many people here remember your birthday? Let me just see your hand. All right, just about unanimous. Now, now, what did your brain have to do for you to respond to that question? Almost instantly. Give you an example of how sophisticated your brain is. First of all, the sound waves have to leave my lips, travel through the air, enter your external auditory meatus, travel down to your tympanic membrane, set up a vibratory force, which travel across the ossicles of the middle ear to the ovum and wand window, setting up a vibratory force in the endolymph, which mechanically distorted the microcilia, converting mechanical energy to electrical energy, which travel across the cochlear nerve to the cochlear nucleus, at the pontomedullary junction, from there to the superior olivarius nucleus, ascending bilaterally up the brainstem to the lateral meniscus, to the inferior colliculus and the medial geniculate nuclei, across the thalamic radiations to the posterior temporal lobes, begin the auditory processing, from there to the frontal lobes, coming down the tract of Victor Jura, between the memory from the medial hippocampal structures and the mammary bodies, back to the frontal lobes to start the motor response at the Betzel lobe, coming down the cortical spinal tract, across the internal capsule into the cerebral peduncle, descending down to the cervical medullary decussation, into the spinal cord gray matter, synapsing there, going out to the neuromuscular junction, stimulating the nerve and the muscle. So you can raise your hand. And now, see if you can get one of those rap singers to do that. But but that's the simplified version of what your brain had to do. Can you imagine if we'd gone into all the coordinating influences and inhibitory influences, and you could do that without barely thinking about it? What is the human brain capable of if we actually put our minds to something? And that's what we need to get our young people stimulated and thinking about, because there's so many incredible problems that are facing us right now. You know, terrorism, energy, the economy, healthcare. I just want to take a moment here to focus on healthcare, because that is something that is so critical to every single one of us. And I remember when I was an intern and going to those wards at Johns Hopkins, and I would see these people, CEO of this company, president of this organization, crown prince of this nation, dying of some malignant disease. And as important as they are, and as wealthy as they were, every single one of them would have gladly given every penny and every title for a clean bill of health. You begin to realize what you have when you do have good health. And a lot of us don't think about it until we don't have it anymore. But, you know, in thinking about what's going on and the incredible debates going on in our nation right now, think about this. It's not because we don't care about good health. The fact of the matter is we spend more than twice as much per capita on health care than the next closest nation in the world. So it's not that we're not putting enough resources in it. The problem is what I call the fourth branch of government, special interest groups. They've grown so big, so powerful, they cause a lot of unethical, illogical things to be done. They suck up enormous amounts of money. Think about this. Most practices spend 20 to 30% on billing and collection. However, every single diagnosis has something known as an ICD-9 code. Every single procedure has something known as a CPT code. And we have computers, which means that all billing and collection can be done almost instantaneously, electronically, overnight, without this mountain of papers that are generated and armies of people to push them around, which sucks up so much money. Completely unnecessary. Now, some insurance companies might say, well, if it were that easy, an unscrupulous surgeon might say he did two appendectomies when he only did one so he could get paid twice, and who would know the difference? Well, first of all, very few people in medicine would do such a thing. But there are a few. There are always a few bad apples. But the solution to the few bad apples is not to establish a huge and expensive bureaucracy. The solution is what I call the Saudi Arabian solution. Why don't people steal in Saudi Arabia? You cut their hand off. Now, I wouldn't necessarily cut people's hand off, but a medical professional would lose their license to practice forever. They would go to jail for no less than 10 years, and they would lose all their personal assets. You think anybody would even consider fraud under those circumstances? They would check every bill 7 ways to Sunday to make sure it was correct. It would not be an issue. very much like drunk driving is not an issue in Sweden. Why? Because the penalties for drunk driving are so severe. It's part of the culture. You wouldn't even think about it anymore. So that would tremendously drop the cost of healthcare right there. Hundreds of billions of dollars just by doing that one thing. The other thing, making the government responsible for catastrophic healthcare. Insurance companies only responsible for routine health care. Guess what that would do? That would no longer give the insurance company the excuse for raising their premiums. Now you would be able to predict how much they're going to have to put out. Now you would be able to regulate them. Also, by making the government responsible, and some people say, you can't make the government responsible. Are you kidding? They can't do anything correct. That's not right. You know, the reason you can own your home, because you have homeowner's insurance. You wouldn't be able to afford your homeowner's insurance if there were no such thing as a government program known as FEMA. Because the insurance companies would say there may be a hurricane or earthquake or this or that or the other, and they have to keep raising the premiums. You'd have to have that through your employer as well. So there are precedents for making these things work well. Also, if the government were responsible for catastrophic health care, we could stop playing ostrich and we could start looking at some of the issues. For instance, why do we still spend 40 to 50% of healthcare dollars during the last 6 months of a person's life? That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And we are not dealing with it. We would deal with it if, in fact, the government was responsible for catastrophic healthcare. And also, a lot of doctors poke and prod people during those last 6 months of life because they're afraid not to. They're afraid they're going to get sued. Well, that problem would get taken care of also if the government was responsible, because you can't sue the government. But we need to use logical things like that. What about the 47 million people who have no insurance, or 20 or 15 or whatever the number is? They do have insurance because they can go to the emergency room. And they have to be taken care of by law. And it costs five times more to take care of them in the emergency room than it does in a clinic. So what we need to do is say, is there a way that we can spend economical dollars versus premium dollars? Is there a way we can get them to go to the clinic rather than the emergency room? Again, a good government program is an example. The food stamp program. People don't starve in this country because of food stamps. Now, they get a monthly allotment at the beginning of the month. They learn very quickly not to go out and buy steak the first 5 days and starve the rest of the month. People would do the same thing if they had a health allotment that was refurbished at the beginning of each month. Now when Mr. Smith gets that diabetic foot ulcer, he's not going to go to the emergency room and blow half of it. He's going to be incentivized to go to the clinic. Same treatment in the emergency room and the clinic. Difference is, emergency room, they fix you up and send you out. Clinic, they fix you up and say, now, Mr. Smith, let's get your diabetes under control so you're not back here in 3 weeks with another problem. A whole nother level of savings. We have to begin to concentrate on preventive health care. We have to begin to think about wellness instead of sickness if we really want to get this thing under control. And also, by doing these kind of measures, which will drop the cost of health care tremendously, all of a sudden you can afford your own health care. You don't have to have it through your employer, which means you have total portability. Go anywhere, not connected to your job. By freeing the employers of this responsibility, they're able to create a lot more jobs. So there's up and up in many, many different ways there. Also, if you own your own health insurance, I can say to you, if you get an annual physical exam, you get a 2 or 3% discount. That will incentivize you to get an annual exam. We catch things early, a whole nother level of savings. These are the kinds of logical things that should be done. And we all need to raise our voices and talk about logical things and not allow politicians, and that's all they are, quite frankly, is politicians who are interested in preserving their power base. But if you go back and you study the history of this nation was created of the people, for the people, by the people, not of the government, for the government, and by the government. And until we learn that, it's going to continue to devolve. People need to reestablish their power. And I'm saying this to groups all across the nation. because I think there may be a limited amount of time and people need to speak up. You cannot be silent. You cannot allow television and the forces of political correctness to make you shut up and kowtow to what the elite say is the right thing to do. Now, I don't want to sound like a radical and like I'm trying to start a revolution, but the fact of the matter is, this country was started by a revolution. We need to recognize who we are as individuals. Healthcare is just one small part of that, but an incredibly important part of that. Well, learning all these lessons, obviously I had an extremely rapid career. In no time I found myself as director of pediatric neurosurgery at the number one hospital in the nation. People would come from great distances to see Dr. Carson, chief of pediatric neurosurgery. I would walk in the room and they would say, "When is Dr. Carson coming?" Because, you know, they were expecting to see something else. But, you know, no one ever walked out as I began to explain what was going on, even though I was very, very young. Fact of the matter is, it's during a person's youth that they generally get the most accomplished. Most Nobel Prize winners may not get the Nobel Prize until they're in their 50s or their 60s, but it's for stuff they did when they're in their 20s and 30s. You young people, now is the appropriate time. You're full of energy, you're full of enthusiasm, all kinds of great opportunities. Don't be thinking about what you're going to do when you get to be 40 or 50. Start thinking about what you're going to do now. You think about people like Nathan Hale, said, "Give me liberty or give me death." He was 17 years old when he said that. So let's think about what can be done now, not what can be done later. Well, the last point that I want to make here, in order to accomplish anything, you have to take risk. And, you know, some people have called me an excessive risk taker. There was one well-known pediatric neurosurgeon who said, "Carson will operate on anybody who will lay down." Well, that's not true, because I operate on people in the sitting position also. But the fact of the matter is, I would actually look at these cases that came, and some of them did look pretty dismal, but I would ask important questions. I remember there was a young man, well, a baby from Oklahoma, 6 months old, had been to the University of Oklahoma. They did a biopsy on a tumor of the posterior fossa. Told the parents there was no hope to take the baby home. They had 6 months before he would die. And they ended up at Hopkins. I looked at that situation. And it did look pretty dismal, I must say. But I asked four questions. I said, "What's the best thing that happens if I do this? What's the worst thing that happens if I do it? What's the best thing that happens if I don't? What's the worst thing that happens if I don't?" And based on that, I decided to make an attempt to remove this horrible mass, which was intermingled with the brainstem. And I was in Oklahoma last spring giving a public lecture, and a family came up to me. And there was a young man, 20 years old, with him. And they said, "Do you know who this is?" I said, "No." They said, "This is Kevin." They mentioned his last name. They said, "You operated on him when he was 6 months old. He was given 6 months to live. And now he's a normal, functioning, and productive human being." And you know, that's what it's really all about. You have to take risk sometimes in order to achieve something. Nobody ever accomplished anything sitting under the olive tree waiting for things to happen for them. And that's what I mean when I talk about success. In 1997, when I was asked to come to South Africa to head up a team in an attempt to separate type 2 vertical craniopagus twins joined at the top of the head facing in opposite directions, I knew that was going to be a great medical challenge. Never been done successfully before in the 13 cases that had been tried. But I was ready for that. But it was also going to be a great social challenge, because the operation was going to be done at the Medical University of South Africa at Madunsa, the only major black teaching hospital, always the stepchild throughout apartheid and the post-apartheid period. This was going to be their chance to stand shoulder to shoulder with Cape Town, Johannesburg, and all the other great universities. I wasn't ready for that social pressure. I said, "Lord, you got to help me, because more capable and smarter people than me have tried and failed." And as I was studying their anatomy on our 3D workbench, at Hopkins. We can integrate the angiogram, the CAT scan, the MRI into a 3D image, put on your goggles and study it. I noticed that the common drainage system was narrower centrally than it was peripherally. And the traditional neurosurgical literature said you should decide which twin to give the drainage to and then separate them over the course of 3 or 4 operations divided in time by several weeks to months to allow collateral circulation to develop. But I felt impressed that if we operated and concentrated on the area where the drainage system was narrowing centrally, that we could do it in one operation, that they would develop collaterals during that one operation. And when I explained that to the team, they said, "You're the boss. We'll do whatever you want to do." And I remember going to the operating room 2 days before New Year's, big sign over the OR that said, "God bless Joseph and Luca Banda." They were having song service and prayer service. And I was thrilled. I asked them to bring a stereo in so we could play inspirational music. 19 hours into the operation, we were only 3/4 of the way finished. The part that remained was so complex. The blood vessels were engorged. They were adhesed. It looked impossible. We stopped the operation. We went into conference. I suggested that maybe we could cover the area over with skin, come back in a few months, and that they would have developed enough collateral circulation that we could cut through those vessels. They said, "That's a great idea. And I know it would work at Hopkins, but we don't have the ability to keep partially separated twins alive. They'll die." Now I really felt the weight of the world on my shoulders. I didn't have all my fancy equipment that I have at Hopkins. I had my scalpel, my loops, and a prayer on my lips. I said, "Lord, it's up to you." And I went in there and started cutting between those blood vessels that were so thin you could see the anesthetic bubbles coursing through, just daring you to make a nick in them. Make a long story short, when I made the final cut that separated those twins, over the stereo system came the Hallelujah Chorus. And everybody had goosebumps. And when we finished that operation after 28 hours, one of the twins popped his eyes open and reached for the endotracheal tube. The other one did the same thing. By the time we got to the ICU, within 2 days, they were extubated. Within 3 days, they were eating. Within 2 weeks, they were crawling. And today, they're doing well in the 6th grade. But you know, that... Thank you. But that was not the success. The success you had to be there to witness was the reaction of the people who've been following that story so closely. They were literally dancing in the streets. This had been done in their country, in their hospital. And, you know, that's what real success is all about, using your God-given talents to elevate other people. And the very last thing that I want to mention is that we now live in a country where God has become politically incorrect. Many people don't think that you can mention him in public. Some lawyers came to us some years ago, and they said, "You cannot put your Think Big banners up in public schools because each one of those letters means something special, and a G stands for God. And the First Amendment says there can be no government support for religious expression." Well, I reminded them that the First Amendment also says that there can be no government suppression of religious expression. So we had a rather vigorous argument. And I suggested that we resolve it at the level of the Supreme Court, which seems like a bold and reckless statement. But if you knew me, you know I don't make bold and reckless statements. And I knew the very next week I was going to the Supreme Court to receive the Jefferson Award. So I figured while I was there, I would ask, and I did. And just as Sandra Day O'Connor said, they were all wet. They had no idea what they were talking about. And of course that was not a violation of separation of church and state. And people who say silly stuff like that, what do they really know about the origins of our nation? Do they realize that our founding document, our Declaration of Independence, talks about certain inalienable rights given to us by our Creator, a.k.a. God? Do they realize that the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag says we are one nation under God? Do they realize that most courtrooms in the land on the wall, it says, "In God we trust"? Every coin in your pocket, every bill in your wallet says, "In God we trust"? So if it's in our founding documents, it's in our pledge, it's in our courts, and it's on our money, but we're not supposed to talk about it, what in the world is that? In medicine, it's called schizophrenia. And doesn't that explain a lot of what's going on in our nation today? And we need to make it perfectly clear that it's okay to live by godly principles of loving your fellow man, of caring about your neighbor, of developing your God-given talents to the utmost so that you become valuable to the people around you, of having values and principles that govern your life. That's how we reach the pinnacle. And if we remember that, not only will we remain a healthy nation and a pinnacle nation, but we will truly have one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much.
Any questions for you? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have a few questions and answers.
Not many, and I have to say, in 14 years, I've never seen a standing ovation. I'll start with this first question, which begins with Dr. Carson, you rock. Do you know about and do you support research on the benefits of breath work and meditation on healthy brain and body functions? And in fact, there were several questions that speak to that, mm-hmm. and using the right and left sides of our brains.
Well, I think that there's so much that we do not understand about the intangible aspects of the brain. You know, we've been able to identify the lobes, the gyruses, the various tracts, but we still can't tell you where a thought comes from. We still don't understand the human mind. We still don't understand such things as extrasensory perception, which is only extrasensory because we don't know about it. But, you know, as we learn more and more about the brain, and as we find better ways to get in contact with some of those higher mental powers, I think it will become less mysterious. And I support anything that helps us to get there.
Several people said, do you ever think of running for president of the U.S.? You would have my vote. And when are you going to run for office? You have my vote. But then others asked more serious questions. Have you communicated your ideas on health care reform to folks in D.C. Who can integrate them into policy? And if you were to convene four or five other people to talk about health care reform, who would they be?
Okay. I will tell you that if I had a nickel for everybody who asked me if I would run for president, I could finance my own campaign. But, you know, I try to stay out of politics. I'm an independent. I hate partisan politics, primarily because, you know, my main focus is the young people and trying to do something with education in this country. And as soon as you are one party or the other party, you eliminate 50% of the population. Now, you know, we need to do something about that partisanship. There's no question about that. But yes, I can tell you that I talked about a lot of these health care initiatives with former President Bush. He was extraordinarily interested. When I first mentioned this to him, he called in all of his health advisors. He said, you know, this will form the basis. We're going to reform health care in this country. He was enthusiastic. 2 weeks later, guess what happened? 9/11. It was all off the table. As far as the current administration is concerned, I have talked to some of their people. I hate to say it, though, but one of the questions I was asked is, what did you do during the campaign? And that seemed to have an influence on how seriously it was going to be taken. So, you know, I don't, I certainly think, you know, we just have to keep pushing these ideals. We have to put them out there. And we have to get people to talk. And this is such an incredibly important thing that we cannot rush through it. We all need to have our voices heard. And, you know, particularly when it comes to health care, you know, if the Brooklyn Bridge fell down, who would we get to rebuild it? Will we get engineers and architects? Or will we get people who like to talk about building bridges, you know? And I think the same thing with healthcare. We need to get people who actually understand healthcare, who've been working in healthcare, who understand all the issues, and I think we'll come up with a much more effective solution.
I have a handful of questions, and I'm disappointed I won't get to them, but I'm going to ask these last two and then come to the podium for a moment. But what would you say is your number one wellness tip? And then what advice would you give a second-year medical student?
Quit now. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. In terms of wellness, the most important thing is your mental health. the brain. You know, cardiac, very important. Pulmonary, very important. Kidneys. But none of it means anything without your mental health. Protect your brain. And how do you protect your brain? Well-balanced meals. Not a bunch of junk food. 6 to 8 glasses of water or water equivalent substances per day. Regular sleep. Regular exercise. And don't put harmful substances into your body. I'm talking about smoking, drugs, and alcohol. Leave those things out. Those are not good for the brain. Some people will try to find ways to tell you that they are good for the brain. Don't listen to them. As far as the second year medical student, learn how you learn. We all learn in different ways. Don't try to fit yourself into somebody else's pattern. And play to your strengths. Play away from your weaknesses. You'll learn a lot more, a lot faster. You know, when I was a first year medical student, I was trying to fit myself into other people's pattern. And I did terribly on the first set of comprehensive exams. And my counselor suggested that I drop out of medical school. Said I wasn't cut out for medicine. And, you know, I just prayed for wisdom. And I went home and I started thinking about it. And I said, what kind of courses have you done well in? What kind of courses have you struggled? And I realized I struggled in courses where I listened to a lot of boring lectures because I didn't get anything out of them. And I did well in courses where I did a lot of reading. And there I was listening to 8 hours worth of boring lectures every day. So I decided to skip those lectures, spend that time reading. The rest of medical school was a snap after that. And I remember going back to my medical school as the commencement speaker some years later. I was looking for that advisor. I was going to tell him he wasn't cut out to be a counselor. You know? Negativity.
Okay, I have one final question, but I want to join you at the podium.
Okay.
But first, I'd like this Penn State crowd to join me in thanking Dr. Carson for coming today.
Thank you.
I think he has a crowded wall. I understand there are 40 honorary degrees, but we hope you'll find a place for this plaque that says you've been to Penn State and how much we appreciate it, and this official Penn State Forum mug.
I will display it proudly. Thank you.
Before you go, though, I do have one final question. As one of the foremost authorities on the human brain, how would you respond to Robert Frost's observation? The brain is a wonderful organ. It starts working the moment you get up and does not stop until you get into the office.
I think that's a rhetorical question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.